The Vintage Gamer, Episode 28, Tales of the Arabian Nights.
You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing!
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. Each week, I take a look at a game from the past, either a board game, card game, role-playing game, or computer game. And if you like what you hear, you can download more great episodes or even subscribe at www.thevintagegamer.net. First of all, let me apologize for the long delay. Actually, I spent a week being sick with some rather strange illness. It wasn't actually a cold. I was just kind of tired all the time. I'm feeling much better now, so I'm not sure what it was, just something going around the office, and pretty much everybody had it, and it was very strange. Anyway, speaking of more great episodes, I've been slowly doing some revisions of the website, and one thing that I've added is an archive page. In checking my stats, I've noticed that the first 9 or so really haven't been listened to much, probably because they're not showing up in the RSS feed. So those of you who are new might want to go back and check them out. I think there's some pretty good stuff in there. I've also started putting up some interesting articles that I run across in the blog feed again. The big recent news for vintage gaming types is that Hannibal, Rome vs. Carthage, is finally being reprinted. Not by Multiman Press, as one would expect. They've sort of become the Avalon Hill reprinters these days, but actually it's being reprinted by a Canadian company called Valley Games, who did the great version of Die Macher. The pre-orders for that open on February 1st, so go check that out at www.valleygames.ca. And I don't think I mentioned last time that I did a narration for Escape Pod recently, the great science fiction anthology podcast, reading the Jack Skellington story, Being There. It was a lot of fun to do and a great honor to be asked by Steve to do that. And I offer a warm welcome to any new listeners out there from Escape Pod. And with that, I'm going to keep the news section a little short this week, as the game description is a bit long. So I'll be back with the game right after this.
This is the Kingfish.
Along with the Vicar.
And Super Geek Billy
from the Geek Label Podcast.
Sure, there are other geekish podcasts out there.
But really, who are we kidding?
Do you want your geek news?
Do you want your thoughts shared across the globe?
Looks like you've got mail waiting.
Do you want a chance to win amazingly cool t-shirts?
Well, the game is afoot.
News, information, prizes.
We'll bribe you if we have to.
A look at any and everything from hardcore geek to stealth geek.
And if you're not careful, you may learn something before it's done.
Don't believe me? Then check out this completely random man on the street testimonial.
Hi, this is George Takei. I love listening to the Geek Label Podcast, and you will too.
Get your geek on with the Geek Label Podcast.
Another quality product from Geek Label.
Listen, O Sultan, and I shall tell you the tale of Goldberg, he who created diversions aplenty, the one who, with Kostikian, devised the cunning tale of a computer gone mad, the one who, alone, devised the ancient game of questing for dragons, and the one, again with the clever Kostikian, created a game that celebrates thee and this land, and all who dwell within it. Oh, all right, enough of that. Sir Richard Burton, I am not. The game this week is Tales of the Arabian Nights, originally published in 1985 by West End Games and designed by Eric Goldberg, with a little help from Greg Kostikian. And Eric Goldberg was a co-designer of Paranoia, again with Greg Kostikian, and a designer of the Dragon Quest RPG. I covered that one a few episodes back. And like Barbarian Prince and Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, another couple of games I've covered, this is a paragraph-based game. And just to review, paragraph-based games are a subgenre that first appeared and thrived in the early 80s. They are named for their most notable feature, which is a big book of descriptive text. And this can either consist of a preset plot or a complex set of random lookup tables. Now, I just covered Sherlock Holmes, which falls under the former, and Tales of the Arabian Nights falls under the latter. The book in this case is called The Book of Tales, and is a large volume of 1,600 numbered paragraphs. Now, going back to the history, later in his career, Eric Goldberg started becoming interested in online gaming, long before it was fashionable. He founded the company Crossover Technologies to start exploring that realm, and one of the games that they tried to create was a computer version of Tales of the Arabian Nights. However, they discovered that it would never be published. Basically, nobody would actually put it out. So they shelved it. In around 1999 time frame, the design work that was done was eventually shipped around to various board game companies for a reprint. West End Games was having financial troubles at the time, so that didn't work out. But no English companies were interested, so it ended up being printed by Edition Irrkönig in Germany and Gallimard in France. Now, as you might expect, this game is not very available, so because of the lack of availability of the first edition, I'm just going to cover the second edition. As I understand it, there aren't a lot of differences between the two other than some minor rules tweaks and a major revision of the Book of Tales, both done by Kevin J. Maroney. And since I don't have access to that first edition book, well, you get the idea. I have what I have. The rules of the game are actually pretty simple. You and up to five other players play characters from the Tales of the Arabian Nights. Your goal is to become the Sultan, or to meet a certain number of destiny and story points, which you set secretly ahead of time. Once you meet one of those goals, you return to Baghdad in glory and win. The game is played on a map of Europe, Africa, and Asia. And, as is only appropriate, Arabia and Persia are the largest relative areas of the board. They are, of course, the only civilized sections. Where you can move is represented by points with various terrain types connected by lines of travel. So, not only is this a paragraph-based game, but it's also a point-to-point game as well. At each location, it's possible to have an encounter, which, depending on how you respond to it, will either give you some sort of reward or some sort of penalty. Usually, your encounter is controlled by a deck of cards called the Fate and Encounter deck. The exception is when you land on certain locations called Places of Power, which can give you special encounters, and from there, special rewards. Actually, there is another exception, which is you can play cards which will give you encounters at certain locations. Now, as I mentioned, the paragraph-based part of the game is contained in the Book of Tales. And this book contains the text of all encounters, plus the results of any response you make to an encounter. As is appropriate to the genre, the Tales of Arabian Nights, the paragraphs are highly florid and descriptive, and the book itself is probably most of the cost of the game in paper. The English version is 200 pages, actually I think it's over 200 pages, and I don't recall, but I'm betting the German one is probably longer. The Germans do like their compound words. So, to the details. As I mentioned, each player is a character from the Tales of the Arabian Nights. You are represented on the board as a pawn of your color, which starts off in the glorious city of Baghdad. You begin the game as either a male or female character, represented by a cardboard token which you flip either to one side or the other. Now, your sex can change during the game, so don't become too comfortable with your choice. As this is an RPG-style game, your character has scores and abilities. First of all, you have, I mentioned these before, destiny and story points. You start with one destiny point and one story point, and throughout the game you'll mostly gain these through encounters and quests. It is possible to lose destiny points, but story points can't be lost. And as both of these increase, you'll get certain bonuses to your character. Destiny points give you more interesting encounters and allow you to improve your skills. I'll cover those in a moment. Story points give you new skills and can improve your wealth. I guess because a good story is always worth something. You can tell that a writer wrote this game. You also have a wealth level, which varies from beggar to fabulously wealthy. Initially, you start out poor, and, like destiny points, can gain or lose wealth through the game. Wealth is used to control how far you can move and can be used with the optional merchant rules. Throughout the game, you can also collect specific treasures, which may or may not help your wealth level, but do give you some bonuses. At the start of the game, you also get to pick 3 skills, and like the other characteristics, you can gain more, or even lose the ones you have, during encounters. Most of them don't have an active bonus. They come into play when you have encounters, and control how the encounter is resolved. On the other hand, a few do. For example, there's Seamanship, or German Seefahren, which improves your movement over sea areas. Bargaining and Negotiation will give you a bonus when using the Merchant Rules, which are optional rules that I'll cover later. And with an optional rule, you can actually use skills when in the same space as another player to attack them. However, other than those exceptions, for the most part, these skills really only come into play during encounters. Now, skills start out at talent level, but if you are granted a skill during an encounter and your destiny points are greater than 7, then you can upgrade a skill to master level. This gives you some advantages when handling encounters, which I'll cover in a bit. But for now, I'll just say that the change from talent to master is indicated by flipping your skill token over from the T side to the M side. And finally, there are statuses, which are active. Some of these are good, such as Sultan, which is pretty good. Married, which I'll say is good, because Murr's probably listening. And Blessed. But most are just plain bad. Take Insane. If you have this status, then you have to choose another player to make decisions for you during encounters. Or Outlaw. In this case, upon receiving the status, you place a marker on the nearest city and are banned from there. If you go back there or receive Outlaw status again, then you are imprisoned. Another status, where you get stuck in jail until you can escape. Unlike skills, which pretty much stick around unless you have a bad encounter, there are active ways to lose most bad statuses. For example, once you get imprisoned, you're no longer an outlaw. Yay. Good statuses also pretty much stick around. One big exception is Blessed. In this case, you pick how you want your die rolls to fall, and then roll anyway. If you are more than one number off, then you lose your blessing. Now, players don't start out with any statuses, and like everything else, they're going to gain them through encounters and also possibly through quests. In the basic game, you can only have one status at a time, and new statuses override the existing one. This is another way to lose bad statuses, but you can also lose good statuses this way as well. With the advanced adventuring rules, you can have more than one up to no limit. So the only way to get rid of them that time is through the rules I mentioned before. Now, one thing I didn't mention is that you can sometimes get conditional skills and statuses. In this case, the skill or status might last only until a certain die roll. So, for example, a roll of 7 or less with 2 dice. For skills, there's also a one-use condition. It's pretty obvious. You get to use it once, and then it goes away. And there are also companion skills that can be tied to a status and go away when that status goes away. So, for example, you can end up being blessed with scholarship and courtly graces at master level. If you lose the blessed status, then the scholarship and courtly graces are lost too. So, that's a fair amount of info on just your characters. Well, it is a role-playing game after all. What about the gameplay? Well, there are 4 different versions of the game, which is why this podcast is going to be a little longer. There's the standard, or basic version, the storytelling version, the adventure version, and the solitaire version. I'm going to start with the standard version, and then I'll just describe how the others are different. In the standard version, on your turn, you do 5 things. First, the Book of Tales is passed to the player on your left so he or she could read for you. Second, you check your status and treasures and how they might modify your turn. Third, if you can, you move. Now, a status may prevent that from happening. Fourth, if you're not in a place of power, you draw a fate or encounter card. Fourth and a half, you resolve any encounters. Fifth, if you're in a matching city or meet any other requirements, you can play a fate card from your hand and handle the consequences. Fifth and a half, you roll dice for any conditional skills and statuses and make any changes to your character due to the results. Okay, so it's really seven things. Still, it's pretty manageable. Okay, so the first two parts are pretty simple. You're just passing a book and then you're checking to see what you have in your character. So then movement. Movement is pretty simple. You check your wealth level and that tells you how far you can move on either land or sea. If you're moving via both, you can move up to the larger number in spaces, but you can't move any more than the smaller number on that terrain. So for example, if you can move 5 spaces by land and 3 if by sea, you can move up to 5 spaces, but you can't move along 4 sea spaces and then 1 land space. You can move at most 3 sea spaces. Or is that 1 if by land and 2 if by sea? Well, William Dawes would know. And no, Paul Revere didn't receive the signal. Go look it up. Anyway, handling encounters is just about as simple, but it's a little confusing in the rules. I'll try to do a little better here. So then you move and you draw from the Fate and Encounter deck. And you check the type of the card. If it's an encounter card, a character or a terrain encounter, then you place it down. Otherwise, it's a Fate card and you get to keep it in your hand, up to 2 cards. Terrain encounters have a series of terrain types, with a number next to each type. And depending on what terrain you're in, your Book of Rules helper will turn to that paragraph number and there find a table of results. You then roll a die, which can be modified by a destiny point modifier. So if you have 5 or more points, you add 1, 9 or more, you add 2. See, that's where it modifies the encounters. You can also add a location modifier if you're outside the civilized world, i.e. outside the area immediately around Baghdad, and that modifier is +2. So for most of the game, you're going to be adding that +2. You check that result in the table, and that gives you a character to encounter. There is an adjective associated with that character, and there is an encounter table letter. So, for example, you might encounter a jovial sage and have to turn to encounter table B to decide how you would approach him. Now, going to table B, you look at the line marked jovial, and you'll see a set of possible reactions. So it could be attack him or talk to him, or supplicate yourself before him. Things like that. Associated with each reaction is another paragraph number. Now, you'd think you'd turn to that page directly. We certainly skipped this part in the game you played. But no. To actually add some randomness to the proceedings, the reader will roll a die. And on a 1 or 2, will subtract 1 from the paragraph number. And a 5 or 6 will add 1 to the paragraph number. That final paragraph number will give the awards for your reaction. This award paragraph has a series of possible results as well, depending on what your skills are. If none of your skills match those listed, then you just use the result marked no skill. Otherwise, you have the choice of taking the result for your particular skill. So, for example, if you decided to attack somebody and you had a weapon mastery skill, that might give you an advantage in the encounter. Now, you could be taking a chance, weapon mastery might not be there, and the person will just beat you up, take you all your money, and leave you penniless, or wounded. Now, you actually do get a further choice if you are a master in a skill. If that's the case, then you can choose further. What will happen is the reader will look up the results for all your possible award paragraphs, instead of doing that roll and choosing -1 or +1. If any of those match your master skill, then you have the opportunity to choose that paragraph. So that's managing terrain. Characters are slightly different, but they're pretty much the same. For a character card, the initial number you will turn to will depend on the time of day. So one thing I didn't mention is there is a time of day marker, which starts out as morning. Once you run through the deck once, that increases to afternoon, and then when you run through the deck a second time, it'll increase to night and just stay there. So, as you might expect, nighttime encounters are more difficult than morning encounters. However you get there, you'll get another table to roll on, and so on to the encounter matrix and resolution. Now, if you land at a place of power, which you can only do through some special circumstances, you actually have 3 possible choices, and the reader will read them out, and it'll be some very florid text describing what you can possibly do, and you just say, I want choice 1, choice 2, or choice 3. From there, you will jump immediately to encounter Matrix E, which will help you to resolve those choices. And I have to point out that this is very important. Nowhere in the English rules does it explain this. The German rules are actually much more friendly in this regard, and so together with the Google Translator, it's how I figured this out. So I strongly recommend you remember, encounter Matrix E for places of power. So after you have this encounter, whether via the deck or the place of power, then you have an opportunity to play a fate card from your hand. So remember those cards that you kept that weren't terrain or character encounters? Most of those are city encounters, and to activate those, you just go to that particular city and play that card after dealing with any encounter results. Now, there are 6 values on the card. Again, you just roll a die and you take the result. Note this can lead to another encounter in the Book of Tales, and on that a paragraph number and a table letter will be indicated. In addition to the city encounter cards, there are special fate cards, which just give you bonuses if you meet the conditions given. One example is, if you're in the same space as somebody else, you can use a skill against them. Note, this only applies if that rule is active. And the final thing you do is to roll for any sort of conditional skills and statuses, just to see if you get rid of them or not. And then the player to your left passes the book to his or her left, and play continues. As I mentioned, the game is played until someone returns to Baghdad as the Sultan, or with their chosen goals of destiny and story points. Then there is one last turn where everyone else tries to get to Baghdad. And whoever ends up in Baghdad, with a winning condition, wins the game. Now note, more than one player can get to Baghdad and win this way. And that's pretty much the standard game. While there is a fair amount of detail, and all of this does sound kind of complicated, it really isn't in play. The flow of play is just those 7 steps I described. Pass the book, check status, move, draw, handle encounters, play cards, and roll for conditional statuses. It's kind of like the cards in Arkham Horror. Most of the complexity comes in the paragraphs themselves, and once you understand how to decode them, it's pretty straightforward. We played this version the first time, and while I think we enjoyed it, there was some confusion about the places of power, as I said, I think I'm safe in saying that we were looking for a shade bit more. Because of that, I'd recommend trying either the storytelling or the adventure game versions instead. The standard game should really be called the basic game, as it's more of an introduction to the mechanics. And I'd say that whether you want to play the storytelling game or the adventure game will depend on whether you're more interested in this game as an RPG player or as a board game player, respectively.
Hello, this is Rainer Knizia. You are listening to The Vintage Gamer. And by the way, I've been bullied into this, but the lady next to me is just too beautiful, so I couldn't say no. Enjoy!
The storytelling game is nearly identical, except when it comes to the paragraph describing the rewards. At this point, the current player takes the Book of Tales and reads the text there to themselves. They then spin a tale embellishing on the given text, but meeting the same sense. They must include their reaction, the characters there, and the given result. And then they have to read the original text so that the other players can hear the difference, and then propose an experience reward, some sort of destiny point or story point, and an additional reward, which can be a wealth level, treasure status, or even more destiny points and story points. At this point, they secretly choose one player to be a supporting character in their encounter. And then the other players get to vote on your story, your embellishment. If most vote your story unsatisfactory, then you only get the awards that the encounter would normally give. If most vote your story satisfactory, you will get the additional experience reward, the destiny point or story point, but not the additional award on top of that. And if most vote your story outstanding, you will get both awards. You can then reveal your secret accomplice, and he or she will get the additional awards you do, but not the rewards you'd normally get from the encounter. So, you can see from this, if you always vote unsatisfactory, it's pretty likely you'll never get a supporting award. Either you'll end up screwing the current player so that they'll only get a base award, and so they'll have nothing to give away, or no one will ever want to pick you as a supporting character. In fact, the game suggests that you don't use your potential reward or the potential gain for the current player when passing judgment. Basically, don't treat this as a strategic decision in the game. Instead, you should really truly judge the story on its merits. And be fair about it, because some people just aren't very good storytellers. I will say, however, those people who aren't good at storytelling, probably wouldn't have much fun playing this version anyway. For example, we have a French-Canadian friend who really doesn't like playing Once Upon a Time, just because of that language barrier. And this version of the game probably wouldn't be for her. For those who aren't looking for the storytelling aspect, but are instead looking for more strategic choices, there are the adventure rules. And this is not a single block of rules, but instead is really a collection of optional rules that you can pick and choose from. The first optional rule is the quest game. In this one, you will always have an active quest in front of you that you are trying to complete. If you complete two quests and return to Baghdad, then you win the game, just like being Sultan or meeting your destiny at story point goal. Most fate cards have a bold-faced section on them that represent a quest. In the original version, I believe these were upside down. If you don't have a current quest active, either because it's your first turn or you just finished a quest, on your turn you will draw cards until you get one. And a quest will lead you to a city, and an encounter with a particular person there. Once you get there, you can choose to end the quest with that person by rolling a die and taking the results from the encounter, or you can choose to try to extend it. If you extend it, then you draw another quest card and go to that city. If you end it, then you do what I said, you roll the dice, resolve the encounter with that person, and take the award. And you should note that the award may extend the quest whether you like it or not. So, why extend it? Well, each time you extend, you get an additional +1 on your die roll. And as the low value results for most quests are kind of crummy, and usually end up with the quest failing, well, you see why you want to boost that value up. You want to increase your chances of meeting the quest. However, if you do risk it, it is possible for you to win a lot sooner. You get that 6. But that's taking a big chance. Another optional rule is the merchant game. Here you're trying to build a trade route from one city to another via a special chart display and some arrow tokens of varying directions. By building trade routes, you can increase your wealth, and if you become fabulously wealthy with at least one treasure, you can return to Baghdad and win the game. So there again, another optional winning condition. So how do we do this? On your turn, if you have an encounter in a city, you can draw one trade route arrow for each wealth level that you're willing to spend. So you're going to be decreasing your wealth level by doing this. Plus an additional arrow if you have the bargaining and negotiation skill. You then place these arrows on the board, starting from a square representing one trade good type, which must be in the city you're starting in, and moving across the chart and through other trade goods. Now, if you're in a city that's the final destination of a trade route, you can cash in the route for one wealth level for every arrow on the route in any intermediary cities. Now, the sharp-eared among you will realize this only benefits you if one of two things happen. You have at least one intermediary city, or you have the bargaining and negotiation skill. Otherwise, you spend wealth levels just to gain those wealth levels back. Of course, all of this assumes you manage to complete a trade route, otherwise you're out of a lot of wealth levels. Now, there is one other way of doing this, which is you can ride on other people's trade routes. They can get to a certain point, and you just have to go and, bink, place one down, and then you take all their trade. However, you can't depend on that, and because of this, I highly recommend taking bargaining and negotiating if you want to try being a merchant. With that, you get one free trade per encounter without gambling any of your wealth, which is always a good idea. The third optional rule is called interactive card play. Not sure how I feel about this one, but in this one, each player is dealt 5 fate cards, which they hold for the other players. Instead of drawing an encounter card, you request one from another player. If they have one, they give you a card. If they don't have one, they must discard their hand and draw 5 new ones. Similarly, when you get an encounter card, if you have a city encounter or other special fate card in your hand, you must give it to that person. Otherwise, you discard your hand and draw 5 new cards. And dealing with quest cards is similar. The fourth optional rule I've mentioned earlier, and that's allowing multiple statuses. And hence, as I mentioned, the only way to lose them is via the conditional rules or the normal ways of losing statuses. And as the rules indicate, this can get a little confusing as the statuses build up. Finally, there is an optional rule that allows you to use your skills against players that are in the same space as yourself. Doing this costs you 5 destiny points for a talent skill and 2 for a master skill. The result depends on the skill, of course, and usually gives a bad status to the other player. For example, using the weapon mastery skill against another player makes them wounded. And while there are some interactions between the players in the standard game, like someone acting for you if you're insane, this addition, this optional rule, does make the game a little less of a solitaire game. It also gives the players a chance to stop a runaway leader, although the cost is rather high. There is one special fate card which allows you to do this for free, but you're depending on being able to get that, of course. So that's the adventure game. And the final game is the solitaire game. This one is pretty much a subset of the adventure game, where you use the quest and merchant rules, and you actually draw 2 cards at a time. The final goals are much tougher as well. You must fulfill the fabulous wealth goal, become Sultan, and complete 2 quests, all before finishing the deck once. There are some other minor modifiers which mainly deal with the cases where you'd normally interact with other players, but in all other aspects, the game's pretty much the same. I actually sat down and played a good deal of this solitaire version, and I found it much more enjoyable than my sessions of Barbarian Prince. As I believe I mentioned, with Barbarian Prince, I never felt like I was building up my character and becoming more and more successful. Just one random encounter could easily take away everything that I had gained. But with this game, I still could suffer setbacks without losing everything. Plus, the results of the choices you make are not completely random, particularly if you get up to master level in your skills. So I have to say this is actually one of the few games I can see myself playing solitaire. It doesn't have that massive setup time of Arkham Horror, nor the potential for massive death, and it doesn't have the once you've played it, you're done aspect of Sherlock Holmes. Overall, I recommend this game for those who like that kind of Fantasy Flight style of RPG / board game. It doesn't have quite as much interaction as I would like, but if you think of it less as a strategy game and more as a race to tell the best story, it's really cool. So I don't think the lack of interaction is really a serious flaw. I will say that some players who don't like their games determined by a roll of the die might not like this one because there is that randomness involved in the encounters, but really the die rolls aren't a huge part of it. And besides, I think the alternate rules add a lot for such players. I mean, if you want to maximize your wealth through the game, then you play the merchant game. If you want to have more control over the adventures you have, then play the quest game. If you want to spin wild tales and wow your fellow players, then play the storytelling game. With the multiple goals and the multiple playstyles, I think this game can have something for just about anyone who wants to play it. Unfortunately, this is another one of those games which is out of print, even in the German edition. It is still possible to find copies of the German edition on eBay and Board Game Geek Marketplace for reasonable prices. That's where I got mine. If you're an English speaker, then Patrick Corner has some translations and paste-ups available for the components, and you can contact him on BGG for the information. For my part, I found that the card paste-ups aren't quite the right size. Maybe I didn't print them out right. But once you memorize the German names for the terrain types, the only cards you really need to look up are these special fate cards. We also used the German tokens just because they were already on the thick card stock. And again, with the exception of the skills, they're pretty easy to figure out. And as far as that, I'm planning on adding the German words to the English player sheet. So that should take care of that problem. I have mentioned a couple of caveats when playing, and I think I'd like to reiterate those just to be sure. First of all, make sure you roll before choosing the award paragraph. And second of all, make sure you use Encounter Matrix E for the places of power. I do have one other caveat with the German version, which is that, rather than the one Fate and Encounter deck that is mentioned with the English one, there are actually three decks of cards. One is sort of a cheat sheet for all the statuses, with one card per status. So you don't really need that, but just to be confusing, it's the deck with the name of the game on it. You'd think it'd be the main deck, but no. Another is a collection of all the treasures, which is convenient for handing them out to players. Of course, they're all in German, so that usefulness might be limited unless you can get the paste-ups on there. And of course, does it have a picture of a treasure on it? No, it has a picture of a mermaid. It has a picture of a mermaid who seems to be lacking her two seashells, if you know what I mean. I suppose that could be considered a treasure, but not really. And finally, the Fate and Encounter deck has a picture of Baghdad on the back. And that's really the only active deck in the game, so just be aware of that when playing. And speaking of the mermaid, did I mention this game is not for kids? Or adults who don't enjoy salacious behavior? Neither are the tales of Scheherazade. Try reading Burton someday. It's something else to be aware of. Arabia was a naughty, naughty place, at least in the stories. So, that's about it for Tales of the Arabian Nights. I'll be back with some feedback right after this.
Warning, the following information is classified top secret. Well, okay, that's not true, but we think it's cool just to tell you that. The subject of this dossier is Random Signal, a podcast produced from an underground super ultra mondo secret facility located somewhere in the Durham, North Carolina area of the mid-Atlantic United States. Its host is Jason Adams, codename Kryptonaut, called by some as a rebel, a geek, and a spitting image of Jane from Joss Whedon's Firefly. Random Signal is a podcast for the independent musician, offering a platform for music too good for the mainstream music industry. More data can be obtained on the Random Signal at randomsignal.com. It is your mission to fill your podcatching client with many episodes of Random Signal, a podcast that is so totally Airwolf that Ernest Borgnine is starting up a Backstreet Boys tribute band just so he can get an interview on it. Subscribing to Random Signal is your first priority. End of file.
The big piece of feedback on the previous Fool's Errand episode comes from Cliff Johnson himself, the designer of the Fool's Errand. As some background, I sent him a note when I ordered my two copies of his latest game, and in there apologized for semi-pirating the Fool's Errand and told him about the podcast. He writes, "Jim, just downloaded the file and listened to it. How fun. Chicken or the egg, did I jinx my publishers or did they jinx me?" I call the mask puzzles XOR puzzles because it was the first thing I thought of when I learned how to use the XOR, in parentheses inverse, mode of polygons. You are not alone in finding those difficult, though I find it depends on the individual. With both Fool and Three, they're almost like human acuity tests, checking for various reflexes and modes of thinking. I appreciate the broadcast, or podcast, and I think it accounted for a flurry of pre-orders from your fans. Mea culpa, thoroughly absolved. Cliff. So, big thank you to you guys if you actually did go out there and order copies of the game. Other than that, I did get a few nice comments on the episode, most of them saying something like Kevin Bury. Excuse me if I screwed up the pronunciation. He writes, "I discovered this game in 1990 or so on my boss's computer. Didn't get much work done for weeks." He concludes, "Nope, never finished it." Well, all I can say to that is, now's your chance. On the last show, I didn't have much on Sherlock Holmes feedback. Since then, Don Dem of the Pulp Gamer podcast wrote me to tell me how some of the members of his show had coincidentally played it right around the time I shipped mine out, and talked about it on a recent episode. So, thanks for the mention there, Don. And that brought to mind a piece of feedback from Rob Ritchie that got lost in the shuffle, which says, "Hi, Jim. For many years, this game played an important part of my wife's and my New Year's celebrations. We'd pour the cocktails and try to outwit Mr. Holmes. Not possible. Eventually, we just wandered around talking to people, ignoring the rules for the most part. Fun, fun game, and your podcast was great. I found this kind of funny since the Sherlock show came out around New Year's. Well, I don't know if they played it this New Year's, but still, yet another coincidence. I guess it's just the time of year for Holmes. Oh, and thanks, Rob. I'm glad you liked it. So, that about wraps up the feedback for this week. If you have feedback on this show or the podcast in general, you can send that via email to vintagejim@gmail.com or Skype me at username jvsquare. Or you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net. Or you can comment on the forum thread at BoardGameGeek or RPGNet or wherever else I manage to post to. And thus concludes yet another mysterious episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer will return in a couple of weeks with another game from the past. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.